Today is January the 17th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. You know, recently I had a problem and I figured that, it's the beginning of the year, I might as well get that patch in that Microsoft was putting out on Meltdown and just get it updated on my Windows 10. Well, I had it updated and my system locked out. Unlike the way it's been reported in the press, it does not brick the system, but the lockdown means that I was unable to boot the system properly. I did a little research on it, and it turns out that the Meltdown patch that Microsoft put out had been attributed to antivirus. Well, I'm not running any antivirus programs other than Defender from Microsoft, so what could the problem be? Well, it turns out that the headline news by the mainstream media and the mainstream computer journals kind of didn't quite get it right. It had to do with anti-malware software. I had a program installed to detect rootkit malware, and that, in effect, was interfering with a patch. So I decided that I would just go back to a point where I did not have a problem. Now, to do that, I have to boot up the system and bring it to a restore condition, or the last point that I had, a last good point of restore. It's easier said than done. If you can't boot up the system, how do you do it? Well, there's a couple ways of doing it. It turns out that one of the ways of doing it is that you can bring up the system and go into a recovery stage. The recovery stage says, I want to be able to reinstall the operating system. However, there are options in reinstalling the operating system in which you can bring it to factory fresh condition where there's nothing else on it other than what was sold to you on the machine. The other option you have is you bring it to the original operating system state, but it leaves the file, your data files intact. The third is you have the option of recovering the system to your last restore point, and that was exactly what I did. So anyone who has this problem, just remember that's the way to do it. And the only thing I can say about this is I would just hold off on these patches until they get it right. Unless you really have an urgent need to install the Meltdown patch, hold off on it. The U.S. Supreme Court will revisit a ruling on the collection of internet sales tax. A South Dakota law is making the Supreme Court reconsider a 1992 ruling that you can only apply sales tax if they are physically located in the state. The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear the state of South Dakota's argument that a 26-year-old tax-related ruling should be overturned, which could free state and local governments to collect billions in internet sales tax. The 1992 ruling was Quill versus North Dakota, center on a mail-order business, and it inadvertently set a far-reaching precedent for e-commerce companies by only allowing states to collect sales tax from businesses with a quote-unquote physical presence in a given state. Critics of the ruling have long decried the clause by saying it makes no sense in the age of Amazon and internet e-commerce, and that it disadvantages existing brick-and-mortar retailers and state and local governments. South Dakota passed a law 2 years ago with the intention of overturning the ruling by demanding that retailers with more than $100,000 in annual sales pay a 4.5% sales tax on all sales. The state government then filed suit to have the case heard by the higher courts in an effort to get the measure deemed constitutional. South Dakota argued in its appeal to the Supreme Court, which this week agreed to take up the case. The Supreme Court's decision, which is not expected until sometime later on, has major implications on online businesses and prominent e-commerce companies like furniture seller Wayfair and consumer electronics seller like Newegg, which collect sales tax in only certain states, have expressed opposition to having the ruling overturned, as it would increase prices and remove any advantage they had over physical retailers. Amazon, which long ago decided to start collecting sales tax when it started building fulfillment centers around the country, will also be affected. That's because third-party sellers on Amazon are responsible for collecting the sales tax, and they don't necessarily follow through to record it and properly process it to the respective states and city governments. There's now news that the market has started to lose some steam and prices of high-end flash memory chips, which are widely used in smartphones, have dropped about 5% in the fourth quarter. The $122 billion memory chip industry has enjoyed actually a very unprecedented boom since the mid-2016, expanding nearly 70% in 2017 alone, thanks to robust growth of smartphones and cloud services that requires more powerful chips that can store more data. Memory chips will likely see a gradual price decline now in 2018. Last year's explosive growth gave chip makers cash to reinvest and boost their output production. Analysts said that this supply of NAND flash memory chips in particular will grow 43% this year, up from last year's 34%, but that will cause prices to drop by about 10%. Like everything else in a free market, it's the law of supply and demand. If there's an oversupply, prices come down. If they make adjustments to lower the supply, prices will go up. Last month, during the Christmas shopping season, there were many big sales. It was a very successful selling period for American retailers. And then I see this headline that says, U.S. shoppers abandoned PC makers in hour of need. And that was a Gartner report. And I says, wait a minute, there's something wrong with that. What Gartner said was that American PC market in the fourth quarter and the rest of the world caught a cold. Global sales declined. And this does not match up with the numbers I've been seeing. And then sometimes you have to look at it in greater detail. They said the U.S. saw a steep decline, which offset the generally positive results in other regions. Four of the top five vendors in the U.S. reported declines. Wait a minute now. They all had great sales. Where did this decline come from? They said that on the global stage, Lenovo remained on HP's coattail in second spot by a percentage point. I thought it was a lot more than that. For the year, they said that the PC shipments fell 2.8%, and this doesn't jive. Then, a week after that, another sales study came out from IDC, and IDC said, wow, sales grew for the first time since 2011. HP led the pack, followed by Lenovo and Dell. The market for PC grew during the holiday season last year, which is a first in 6 years of declining demand for computers. And according to this IDC report, which includes desktops, notebooks, and workstations, grew a little bit under 1% over the holiday season. IDC had initially predicted a demand would decline by 1.7%. In first place, of course, is HP, with 22.7% of the market, followed by Lenovo in the teens. Lenovo came in second place, and they were overtaken by HP for the first time in 4 years. The company underwent a restructuring last year as an attempt to reclaim domestic markets. I'm talking about HP now. And it performed well, especially outside the United States with its notebooks. And then you look at it more carefully and say, wait a minute now, these numbers don't match up. And like anything else, the news is, it depends on who writes the news and how you interpret the news. It turns out that Gartner does not include Chromebooks, and they only look at the number of units shipped to channel outlets. In other words, channel outlet would be Newegg, Best Buy, you know, people that will then resell the equipment. And now, wait a minute now. So how is IDC any different? I see IDC is different in that they included Chromebooks, and that was a biggie. And another thing is that in this world of e-commerce now, hey, you know what? I've been buying equipment directly from HP, Dell, and Lenovo, and that doesn't get recorded as a channel sale. So you got to read this very carefully. And I just feel that the PC market is quite healthy, as evidenced by the earnings reported by HP in terms of their computer division. It's everyone had given up for dead, and the guy has done a fantastic job. When they split up the company, they split it up as HP computers and printers, and it's a dying industry, and they took the software part and system part and called HP Enterprise. Guess which one is coming out the better? The computers. It's still the world of computers. We have a couple interesting segments this evening. The first will be Dr. Alfred Paul with a recap of CES. That's a computer electronics show. This will be followed by Marty Winston with his, what he calls, the buses waiting, which is really the I.O. channels. And we have decided that CES is such a major show that we will broadcast a segment from Dr. Alfred Paul from last week in which he met with corporate executives.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Well, I'm back from CES in Las Vegas, and it looks like I've survived another one. Saw a lot of interesting things. I probably met with more than 100 different companies. I do know that I walked almost 90,000 steps in the course of the week. I was pretty busy. Saw a lot of cool things. Can't cover them all here, but I figured I'd pick out a couple major highlights, major topics to go over that might be of interest. So the first one I want to talk about is technology for aging in place. I know that this is an area of interest for a lot of listeners, either because they have older parents who they're taking care of or responsible for, or they're older themselves and don't want to be a burden and want to continue to live as independently as they can. Well, I have to say that I don't think we're moving as fast in this area as I would like to see. Most of the products that I saw on display at CES were still the same old personal emergency response systems, PERS, or PERS as they're known in the trade. And these are the familiar buttons that you wear on your neck as a pendant or something like that. And if you fall or have need help and you just press the button and help gets summoned one way or the other. The problem with these is that studies have shown over and over again that the seniors who have them won't use them even when they need to. Some studies show that as few as 7% will push the button when they're in a situation where they're in need of assistance. There's a lot of good reasons for that, but it's a problem if you're going to depend just on that pushing of the button to bring help. Some people are trying to put lipstick on a pig. They're making them wristbands or something you wear on your belt, but you still have the problem of people not wearing them because they're embarrassed to wear them or not using them when they need to. So one of the things I think that's going to have to happen is we're going to need more products that will respond passively to an event. The primary one here, obviously, is fall detection. Falls are actually the leading cause of death among seniors, which is a statistic that surprised me. Having a device that can automatically detect when the person has fallen and isn't moving or, you know, is needing assistance, having them passively detect that and then issue an alert, I think that's the direction we really need to go. There were very few products on the market on display at CES that had this kind of feature. Fewer still have a totally passive system where the subject doesn't have to wear anything at all. Again, I think this is the future where it can passively monitor the activity within the home and can tell when the person who's there is moving or not and be able to learn what their normal behaviors are and be able to issue alerts when something looks out of the ordinary. There are products like this on the horizon. Vayar is one, V-A-Y-Y-A-R. They hope to have a non-contact activity monitor on the market within the next 6 months, which will be very, very interesting to see, and hopefully they can bring that out. Another problem that a lot of the aging-in-place technology has is that too many of them rely on the person to have a smartphone that is used as a gateway between the sensors and the service. A lot of seniors I know have smartphones and can use them, but I also know an awful lot who need this kind of support who aren't going to be totally comfortable with a smartphone. If it stops working, they may not know how to reboot it or how to restart the application if something goes wrong with it, or if it needs an upgrade, or all the kinds of problems that we have to deal with on a daily basis with most smartphones. And then there's the problem of keeping it charged and running. So we've got a long way to go with aging in place. We're seeing lots of improvement. One of the most interesting aging in place devices I saw was a product that is essentially an airbag for your hips. This one is an example of something that can passively detect if the subject is falling. Like an airbag in a car, it detects whether the person's falling, and if they're falling, it uses compressed air to inflate a belt to turn it into airbags and cushion the impact when you fall and hit the ground. It's a kind of interesting design, but it could make a huge difference and save lives. So that's the direction I think we need to go, where you're not relying on the subject to trigger the alert when they need help. Another topic that I saw at CES is that my prediction about the whole wearable health, digital health movement moving away from consumers and towards enterprise and large-scale applications, there's a lot of evidence for that. There's a company called Somatics, which has sensors that measure vital signs and other digital health kinds of information, and they're selling directly to enterprise-level customers, not to individuals. They collect a lot of data. According to the person I spoke with, they record 500,000 bits of information about the wearer every day. And so this is a lot of information that can then be mined to determine patterns of illness and other kinds of problems, and can be a very valuable tool and encourage employees to be healthy and safe and to cut down on healthcare costs and increase productivity, which is why corporations and others are interested in this kind of technology. Another company, Vuzix, V-U-Z-I-X, they make smart glasses, and they're doing a lot for enterprise applications, but they're also helping provide adaptive technology for people with low vision so that they can be more productive in the workplace. They have glasses that can do object recognition, so they can identify objects in the environment for the wearer if they can't see them well enough, can even convert text to speech, so it can read aloud for them, and these are built into smart glasses. I was talking to an executive from Samsung, and we had a fascinating discussion, but one of the things that was very clear is that they are serious about building security into the software and the hardware used for wearable systems. They've got a technology called Knox, like Fort Knox, K-O-N-X, and this secures the hardware and software, makes the data much safer and protected. They also can do mobile device management, decide which devices can connect to which resources within the company. So you won't have baby cams spying on people and being used as bots for attacks. It's a big advance, and encouraging to see that we're getting serious about security for mobile devices. And then there was another company, Nomadique, which is a French company. And what they've done is created a hands-free artificial reality system for emergency first responders. You can control the system by either gestures or by voice control, and it allows a paramedic to call up patient vital signs and other information, can overlay it right on the body. They can call for help and get a doctor or other healthcare expert to look over their shoulder and have two-way communication about what they're seeing and how to treat them. It's a very interesting product and could save a lot of lives. Finally, if there was one theme that seemed to be all over the place, it was sleep. Everybody was talking about sleep. There were smartwatches. There were things you put in your bed. There was things you put beside your bed. All kinds of devices that are supposed to help manage your sleep. Frankly, I am totally underwhelmed by almost all of these. For the most part, they are sleep sensors, and they track your sleep and tell you how good your sleep was. I really don't find that all that interesting. The way I describe it is, it's kind of like having a weather report where you turn on the weather and the weather person comes on and says, last night the temperature got down to 24 degrees. Thanks for listening to the weather report. that doesn't do you much good. Knowing that it was got down to 24 degrees isn't all that helpful because you were there. You know it got cold. But did they tell you what's going to happen tonight? No. The problem with a lot of these devices and systems is that they tell you what happened, but they don't give you any actionable insight that you can use to have an impact on what's going to happen the next night. Now, some of them do offer sleep training kinds of things and give you advice like go to bed every night at the same time and do calm things before you go to sleep, like read, don't watch television. Frankly, they all say the same thing more or less. And I could very easily print almost all of this training information on a simple 3x5 card, and it would be a whole lot easier than what a lot of these offer. For the most part, these sleep devices, I don't see them offering much value. I don't see that they can tell you much that will be helpful for you. And the worst ones shine different lights. There were ones that played different music or different sounds. There were some that even emitted different aromas in the room while you're trying to sleep to help you go into different stages of sleep. And my thought on that is, well, okay, if you're living alone, that may be okay. But if you're sharing the room with somebody else and they're not on the same sleep cycle as you are, and they don't have to wake up when you have to wake up, it doesn't matter if their alarm clock knows when you're at a light point in your sleep and wakes you up at the best time. That may not be the best time for your partner to wake up. And so I have a feeling that for a lot of these devices, if you have a partner who you share a room with and you start using one of these, you might very well find yourself living alone. So sleep is not all that impressive to me at this point. Maybe they'll come up with something in the future that can help us get a better night's sleep by proactively doing something, but I haven't seen much in that direction yet. So those are some of the big issues and things I saw at CES this year. It was an enormous show, as always, and a lot of fun and a lot of work, and you can be sure that I'll be going back again next year.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred.
How many seats are on a bus? If it's the kind people ride, there's always a limit, so it shouldn't surprise anybody that signaling buses also have limits. You've seen it with Ethernet, where limits are often based on bandwidth, like gigabit, or by IP address counts. USB and USB 2 and USB 3 and USB-C each have the same kind of limits, based on bandwidth and sometimes based on the power load. But you're probably less familiar with the buses for our next era of automation. We've been talking about some two-wire buses that offer tons of opportunities and are crazy helpful, but there's no standing room only for riding these. Either you're in a seat or you're back on the street. Bandwidth, as I'll explain, isn't the only kind of limitation. Take DALI, the Digital Addressable Lighting Interface. Note the word addressable in its name. A single DALI bus has a total of 64 available addresses. And oh yeah, there are lots of places where you have a lot more lights than that to control. The answer for DALI is to set up separate DALI networks, each supporting some cluster of devices that will tend to number fewer than 60, because it's good design practice to keep some spare addresses available. A DALI gateway can address multiple DALI networks, and yes, there are some Raspberry Pi DALI gateways out there. If you're building a new house, or office, or plant, talk to your electrician and lighting specialist about planning around DALI, D-A-L-I, DALI. It's been around for a while, so if those guys don't know what you're talking about, replace those guys. Our sense of the future direction for LED fixtures has a lot of DALI in it, in part because you just add two wires to carry its commands and responses. And it's not just for lighting. It's also for things like ceiling fans or even electric door locks if you want. That's DALI. Now, there's another two-wire bus that's really cool for connecting multiple ICs or sensors or controller boards. Its long name is inter-integrated circuit, or sometimes, but rarely, inter-IC. More commonly, I2C or I2C. There is no limit that I know of to the number of devices you can address over I2C, at least not based on address values. There are two other limits in play, though, and you should know them. One is a limit on the total capacitance the bus can support. I'll go deeply into that in a moment. So let me get very basic. Two-wire data buses only work against a common ground value, so you're really dealing with three wires, plus a fourth if you think about the positive voltage supply to those integrated circuits or sensors, which may not be the same on both sides. For example, you might have 5-volt logic talking to 3.3-volt logic. We'll get to that in a minute. Many electronic devices themselves exhibit capacitance. So does wiring, meaning that if you connect too many devices over too long a wire, the total capacitance, it all adds up, will make the line unreliable. Now, let's dive just a level deeper to understand that. If you're not familiar with electronic components, I'm going to name two, capacitors and resistors. A capacitor is a charge storage device, something like a rechargeable battery, but without the chemicals. If you put a voltage across a capacitor and don't limit the current it sees, the capacitor charges very quickly. If you do limit the current, which is something a resistor does, another basic kind of component, the capacitor charges more slowly. Bigger capacitors can hold more charge than smaller ones. So for a given resistance, a bigger capacitor takes longer to reach its full charge. For a given capacitor, a bigger resistor slows down the amount of current, and again, it takes longer to charge. So how much time does it take a capacitor to fully charge? Well, that depends on both values, resistance and capacitance. If you can remember just R for resistor and C for capacitor, just those two letters, R and C, then after the show is over, go hit Google and look up the term RC time constant. But until then, let's get back on the bus. Remember, I2C has two signal wires, one that carries a clock signal and one that carries serial data. And ideally, those look like clean, square pulses. Oops, too much capacitance. And remember, every sensor has some, the cable length adds some. So all of that capacitance, if it totals too much, the RC time constant means it will take a while before the front edge of that pulse reaches its full value. In other words, instead of a square front, it gets rounded, and that might make for errors in reading its state. Now, there's some design tricks you can pull to correct that, like using charge pump current sources instead of resistors, or inserting some extra signal conditioning, and all of a sudden, a simple two-wire bus gets a little more complicated. There are chips for that. It's not terrible, but stay tuned, because we really want this bus to offer a fast, smooth ride. First, though, there's something about I2C addresses that does pose a limitation. You can't have two devices with the same address on the same bus. In our cybernetic house, that's a problem. We use many sensors that have fixed I2C addresses. You can't program, you can't change them, they're fixed. That's true of four sensors in a four-sensor quad that we use in about 100 places. And in about 30 of those places, at least three of those quads have to connect to the same I2C pins on a Raspberry Pi. Now, there's an answer. It's called a multiplexer. It lets multiple I2C buses connect to a single I2C host. And internal addressing decides what it's talking to. Programming will tell it which way to steer. Each of those multiplexed buses is dividing and conquering the capacitance limitations. So again, more sensors can ride the multiplexed bus. So multiplexers are cool, but there's another kind of chip I want you to know about that's called a logic level converter. It converts between 3.3-volt logic on one side and 5-volt on the other, and if it's bidirectional, as many are, then you don't have to worry about what's what on which side. You just hook one side to one side and the other side to the other side, and you're done. It means that if it's writing a 3.3, 1 or 0, or if it's writing a 5-volt, 1 or 0, it'll be perceived by a 3.3 or a 5-volt logic gate as being the 1 or 0 you intended. So that is a logic level converter. Multiplexers, logic level converters do a whole lot to make I2C a little bit handier to work with. There's a wonderful online resource for not only reading about I2C and how to tame it, but also for getting small and inexpensive boards that let those of you who are hardware inclined play with it. Play with it all. You don't even have to have an Arduino or Raspberry Pi. There's an I2C to USB interface board you can buy so your computer can take that on. The place is called Adafruit. I'll spell it ADA. That's ADA, ADA, Alpha Delta Alpha. Adafruit, like raspberries are a fruit. Adafruit. Now, I should warn you, though, that whatever resistance you may have felt toward getting involved with hands-on electronic experimentation will be severely challenged by the temptations at the Adafruit site. Right now, though, I have a bus to catch, and I don't want to make it back up, back up, back up. I saved you a seat, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. How's the weather in Las Vegas?
It sucks.
Really?
It is pouring rain. It's biblical. It's crazy. And so I did not get here Sunday. I didn't get here till yesterday morning. Mm-hmm. I still got to go to one special private event for the press by a delegation of Chinese technology companies, which was kind of interesting. And then I had a meeting with Samsung and mobile health technology, which is products for aging in place to help seniors and personal, you know, emergency response systems, things like that. And then last night was a show called Digital Experience by Capcom, which again is a press-only event, and that's huge. They had, well, I don't know, maybe 100 exhibitors there, and saw a lot of really cool things there as well. So, and that's just getting started. Then the exhibit hall's open today. I've got a breakfast meeting, then the exhibit hall's open today, and it's half-hour sessions all day long, and then same thing tomorrow. So, busy schedule.
Do you see any progress and technical developments as opposed to all the hype that I've been hearing for the past year and I'm still waiting?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of the products that I've seen 2 years ago and a year ago, they're shipping now. And there's a lot of really interesting innovation going on and new approaches. One of the biggest areas, at least, you know, from my area of interest with wearables and mobile technology for health and medical applications. One of the biggest areas is the whole thing about hearing. There's a new category called hearables, and it's really sort of over-the-counter hearing for people with hearing impairment. So rather than go and spend $4,000 per unit from, you know, a doctor, an audiologist for your hearing aids, they're now simpler devices that only cost a few hundred dollars that can help a lot with people's hearing impairment. And then there's products in the middle that can also, you know, they're sort of the retail kind of hearing aids, but they don't cost nearly as much. One of the outfits that I saw that I was really interested in, the company called Eargo, and they sort of fall in the middle. They're tiny hearing aids that go into your ear canal, so they disappear. But unlike the most hearing aids, most hearing aids are behind the ear. They have all the batteries, electronics back there, and they have tiny little batteries that you have to be able to change. Well, Eargo they've been on the market for over a year, and they have these tiny little things that you just insert in your ear canal. But the cool thing about them is when you take them out, you put them in this little carrying case, and it recharges them. And so you get 16 hours of use on a full charge, which means, you know, full day for most people. And there's no fumbling with the tiny little batteries or anything like that. They just it's a wirelessly recharging thing when you put them in their case, which is really kind of cool.
Well, what I found was that in talking to Joe King, who has a really high-end hearing aid device, is that when he uses it, it somehow interferes with cell phone calls.
That's quite possible. There's so much wireless interference, you know, waves going on. I can imagine that some aren't as well shielded as others, and it could be a problem. There was another hearing product. Let me see if I can find my notes on this one quick, that I thought was kind of interesting. Yeah, it's a company called Even, E-V-E-N. And there's a much lower-end kind of solution, but it's pretty sophisticated. Instead of being ear, in the ear, kind of hearing aids kind of thing, these are over-the-ear earphones that you would wear, like listening to music or television or things like that. But the interesting thing about it is that they have an audio test built right into them, and push a button, and the audio test plays different music samples. And when you can first hear, begin to hear that music, you push a button, and it will automatically diagnose your hearing loss and adjust the music, the sound, to match your responses to the audio test. And they, it's crazy that they have a corded version that you would plug into your TV or your smartphone or whatever you're listening to. But then they have another version that's Bluetooth, wireless connected. And the pricing on these things is crazy. It's $150 for the corded version, and it's $230 for the Bluetooth version. So, you know, compared to expensive hearing aids, this is, you know, this is something that's tuned. They have 8 different frequency bands that they tune it to for each year. So it's really customized, but it's something you do by yourself, for yourself, just over the counter. So there's a lot of good stuff going on just in the hearing products.
One of the problems I find when I go to press conferences is that more than half of the products are in crowdfunding or kickstart mode, as opposed to how many are actually in production and you could actually get it, in the consumer market.
Yeah, that it continues to be a problem. But again, there are products that I've been following, and you know, there's certainly a lot of them that are in Kickstarter or Indiegogo programs. But a lot of these also are really getting. They're real. They're available. For example, Motive is a company that some of the listeners may have heard of. A lot of people are familiar with Fitbit and the other fitness kinds of wristbands that you can wear. Well, Motive is actually a smart ring that you would wear on your finger, but it does all the kinds of things that a fitness band would. Checks your heart rate, tracks your active time, checks your sleep activity, works 24/7 round the clock. And they've improved their algorithms so that they can get better insights from the data that you get from it. This thing runs, it's tiny, right? It's like the size of a wedding ring, yet it runs for 3.5 days on a charge.
That's very good.
And it's awesome compared to a lot of these wristbands. And, you know, it pairs up with your smartphone and all that. Now, this is a product that's been shipping since last September. So, this is a real product. It's out there.
I've been talking to a lot of people, and one of the questions that I get quite often is, are there any products where seniors who are living alone, where there are sensors, devices that can keep track to make sure that they're okay, or if there's something happens, they can, because most seniors don't like to wear that thing around their neck.
No, those things are called PERS, Personal Emergency Response System, and the fact is, they're really loud. The track record for them is not good. As you say, a lot of seniors, it's a badge of shame. You know, it's like pinning a note on the sweater of your kindergarten kid as you send them off to school. Seniors don't like to wear them, and people have tried to put lipstick on the pig by making them look like jewelry pendants or whatever, but it's still a pendant. Problem is, there are a whole bunch of problems with it, but one of the big problems is most seniors won't even push the button when they need help. There's been lots of studies that should follow seniors, and for those who found themselves in situations where they needed emergency assistance, you want to care guess how many push the button?
25%?
How about 7%?
Wow, that's very little.
Less than 1 in 10. But if you think about it, there's a lot of good reasons why they feel this way. For example, they did something stupid. They're embarrassed. You know, they don't want somebody to find out that they were doing something that was a stupid thing to do, but they don't want to be a bother. And another one is, you know, they don't want their adult children to find out because they're going to make them move out of their home and into some managed care facility.
Well, so, you had brought up something on a prior broadcast where instead of making it wearable, you have sensors that you can place in different parts of the room so you can sense movement or any kind of a problem or change in sound.
Right, and those things are coming. There's a number of products that exist already that are pretty nice. There's can't come up with the name of the product at the moment, but there's one that has a sensor that slumps under your mattress, and it measures your activity while you're sleeping, and it can measure the quality of sleep, and then obviously it can tell when you're in or out of bed. So this could be a really good way of tracking the behavior of a senior, and you know, make sure that they're getting in bed and where they should be, and getting out of bed in the morning and not just staying in bed all day and that sort of thing. One of the big problems with that particular product, and many others though, is that it requires a smartphone as its link to the tracking, to you know, caregivers, to family members, and so forth. And a lot of seniors aren't geared to working with a smartphone and keeping it running. I mean, if the smartphone runs into problems, if they need to do updates, that's going to be beyond the scope of most seniors. Fortunately, a lot of companies are now realizing that they need to have some sort of a base station, and I haven't yet found one that I think is perfect, but a lot of them are working towards this idea of having the ability to summon help immediately if you want it, but also to have this passive monitoring. So automatic fall detection, for example, is one of the functions in there. There's one company that I've been tracking for a couple of years. It's called Vayer, V-A-Y-Y-E-R, and they created a radio frequency. They use radio waves. Originally, it was a device that they could look at tumors inside the body, medical imaging, far less money, a much lower cost, but much better accuracy than some of the current medical imaging. And they realized that it had other applications as well. And so the first application they came up with was a little device that you could hold up against the wall, and you can actually look through the wall and find where you have pipes, where you have electrical wires, where the studs are, and things like that. And it can tell the difference between those things. I mean, it can tell if you've got a mouse in the wall. But one of the things that's coming is they have a way of setting up one of these in the home and being able to monitor for fall detection and activity and make sure that the person's moving, even sensitive enough at this point in its current stage that they can measure the breathing rate of the person, so you can get some basic biometrics. That's a product that they expect to have out within the next 6 months.
I have a question for you. Sure. With all these devices, is there any regulation or standards? Because the problem I could see is that with these devices, if you want to get on a plane, you have to take it all off, or TSA will say it's okay, you can wear it.
Sure.
So when seniors want to travel, that's a big question.
Well, yeah. Well, this particular product that I'm talking about, the Vayer one, isn't something that you wear. You just set a box up in the room, plug it in, and you don't have to wear anything. You don't have to put anything on. You don't have to do anything. It just is. It just does it. There are other products like smartwatches and so forth that do have automatic fall detection, but also have an emergency response button. They have GPS signals in them so that they can locate the person if they're away from the home, which is important for seniors who are still traveling, like you're mentioning. But it's just a smartwatch. And so as far as regulations go, it's regulated no more or less, you know, any timepiece that you might wear on your wrist. So that's not a big issue. When you get into situations where it's recording medical data or it's being used to provide data that's going to be used for diagnosis or things like that, then you start getting into the FDA requirements and have to get certification for the FDA, which is a long road and an expensive one, can be expensive. But more and more companies are doing that because people want to know that it's a real product, that it actually does something useful, and that's not just some wild claims that the manufacturer makes without any support.
With the wearable hype on tech, you know, the wearable technology hype, it started, I think, with the Apple Watch. Has there been any increase in that area, or it's really fallen off and gone to different areas?
Well, all hype starts with Apple, so we'll begin with that assumption. And I think that Apple is a bit guilty of raising expectations too high. But the fact is that Apple really is not a very significant player in this whole market. One of the big points that I make is that and I think I did this on a segment in the show not so long ago, but the future of this market is where the money is. And the people, the organizations that are going to make this stuff happen and to put it on at risks or the bodies or the whatever in the homes or whatever of people on a widespread basis, it's going to be the insurance company. It's going to be the big employers. It's going to be the healthcare system. In other words, those are the people who are going to financially benefit from having healthier, having a Fitbit is great if you go to the gym and stuff like that, but end of the month, you're not going to have any more money in your pocket just because you're wearing one of those fitness bands. But end of the month, if you're not sick, your employer is getting more productivity out of you. You're costing them less in healthcare. And so they have a real interest in helping you get healthy and stay healthy. And they're the ones who are going to end up funding a lot of these programs. And we're already seeing this, a number of instances where companies are buying like 10,000 fitness bands at a time to give to employees or to give to companies that they insure, that they provide health insurance for, things like that. So I think that's where the future's going.
One of the things I see that's happening is that the navigation with a lot of these devices are by symbols. Is there any standards developed for these symbols? Because I look at from one device to the other, and I have a hard time figuring out what do they mean.
Standards. So let's jump into the Wayback Machine for a moment, and let's go back to the early 80s when the IBM PC came out. Remember?
Yep.
And it was that big beige box.
Yep.
And the keyboard looked a certain way, and the floppy disks were of a certain size. You know, they were 5 1/4 inch floppies.
Mm-hmm.
And then the IBM clones started to appear. And if you remember, it was the Wild West.
Yes.
We had different size floppy disks. We had different plugs. We had different, everything. And it was just that crazy, expansive, frothy market that was innovating all over the place, but with very low standardization and a lot of duplicated effort. Well, that's what we're going through right now in this whole wearable and mobile health market. Lots of people doing lots of things, in many cases doing the same thing and not knowing it. Somebody else has already done it. And they each have their own little version of why their way is a better way. And so whether it's the user interface, and we're seeing all kinds of things on user interface, from gesture to speech to touch to, there's just all kinds of things going on that people are experimenting with how we interact with these devices. But there are no standards yet. I don't think we're going to get them. I think what we're going to end up with is, just as with computers, we're going to end up with a small handful of companies that are the winners.
When you talk to these vendors, do you ask them how much effort or concerns they have to make it hacker-proof?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the security, we didn't have the internet when we first built the PCs, and so there wasn't a threat of people hacking your computer back then because it wasn't connected to anything. And so I think the technology companies can be forgiven for not building in better security at that level. But there's no excuse this time around. The thing with the Maria hack happened last year, where the bots took over baby cams and refrigerators and all that, and were used for denial of service attacks and other things. There's no excuse for there not being security baked in right at the chip level for these devices. What happened was people saw an opportunity, they wanted to get a product out the door fast. Good enough was good enough, and so security was never really considered for a lot of these. And it's a shame. But we are beginning to see more concern about devices that have better security when they're connected to the internet. We're also seeing interesting devices that take a kind of a different take on this. I don't do a whole lot with the network security devices, but there are a number of companies that are coming out with sort of, I guess the way to put it is the guardian at the wall. It's something that you put between your internet connection and your home network, and it's an intelligent device that's there and watches and can identify when something's not right. when traffic is going that shouldn't be there. So it's much more than a firewall. It's a device that's smart and can actually analyze the data transfers and realize when something is not right.
During the past Christmas holiday, the big item was Alexa. Is any of these devices voice actuated rather than trying to
They all are. Yeah, last year it was drones and VR. This year it's voice interface.
By the way, one of the things I did was that I had to put my Alexa device, I had to mute it so that it doesn't accidentally go on while we're talking.
Right. Yep. So there's a very interesting thing I learned recently about that. So sometimes early on, they had whenever a commercial came on, it would activate people's echoes in their homes, the Alexa. And it turns out that instead of leaving a back door, Google has programmed in sort of a kill switch for the voice recognition. It turns out they have created a narrow band of sound, and if it doesn't detect any sound in that narrow range of frequency, it ignores the voice command. And so what they do is they record the soundtrack of somebody saying, "Alexa, what time is it?" But then they go in and they take out, they silence this narrow band of frequencies, and then your echoes will ignore it when they hear it.
It's good to hear from you, and I hope the weather gets better.
This is Vegas. It has to get better. But
No, you don't understand. When the weather's great, people want to go out. In Vegas, they want the people inside the casinos.
Right, they do. But, it is not Chamber of Commerce weather here in Vegas today.
I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks very much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Yep, bye-bye.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the Northeast Regional Tri-State Area. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on January the 23rd, 7 p.m. on a Tuesday at Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on current trends in personal technology Thursday, January the 25th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. They'll meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Bitcoin, Thursday, February the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, February the 2nd, 8 p.m., at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bardo Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, February the 6th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on my favorite topic, backing up your computer, Tuesday, February the 6th, 1:30 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, February the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be having their meeting Friday, February the 9th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of Harry J. Schur Hall. These meetings are all open to the public, free to attend, and we're looking forward to seeing you there. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, you need to back up. Make sure you back up your files. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and till we meet again, same time, same station next week.